Hello, and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today we're going to focus on modern slavery, an attempt to provide some answers to a simple, yet potentially very serious question. There's modern slavery in my supply chain, what next? This is what faced food and beverages giant Nestle a few years ago when instances of forced labour were uncovered in one of the company's supply chains. The reality is, of course, that most complex supply chains will have modern-day slavery within their operations. It's inevitable. So while companies need to do all they can to prevent slavery and forced labour issues in the first place, what should they do when modern slavery is uncovered? On our panel today, we have Jack Scott, Vice President, Sustainability and Responsible Sourcing at Nestle, who has been closely involved in the company's efforts to identify and tackle supply chain modern slavery in Thailand. Lydia Long, Director of Programs Verity, who has worked closely with Nestle on labour issues. And Michael Quayle, Associate with Freshfields Brookhouse Dieringer, who will be providing some expert legal perspective throughout our discussion today. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Narni Brook-Adil, for helping to convene our panel. The issues we're covering today will be discussed further at Innovation Forum's conference on how business can tackle modern slavery and forced labour on June 12th and 13th, in New York. There are still some discounted passes available. Full details of this interactive and engaging event are on Innovation Forum's website, and the address is in front of you, and I do hope you can join us then. Okay, back to today. I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We'll have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions, particularly during the second half of our hour. Please note that, as at Innovation Forum conferences, to keep things discussion-based, there will be no slides. We do want to hear from our audience, so please submit questions using the questions box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular. And if you can keep your questions short and to the point, it is much more likely that I will use them. So, turning to our panel, I will bring Lydia in for comment shortly, but Jack, could you kick things off, please, and outline the chronology of the problem you found in Thailand? And perhaps, if you can, give us some insight into the internal debate that you and your colleagues had around how to tackle it. Jack.
Hello. Thank you, Ian. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Yeah, so first of all, let me just say thank you so much for giving Nestle this opportunity to speak at this webinar and to share some of this, because we feel as though, right, to your point early on, you have challenges like this. A lot of other companies might have challenges like this as well in their supply chains. And if there's anything that we can do, it's to learn from each other, right? Everyone is trying to figure out ways in which we can make these things go away, or to do remediation, or find ways to basically help improve the situation. And so having this opportunity to speak in front of this forum is really fantastic. So thank you for that opportunity. To kick this off, I'm going to go back a little ways, because this is not one of those things where you just suddenly get a notice one day that you have this issue, right? It's something that comes up and you slowly start to build into learning more and more about it. And I'm going to take us back all the way to around the summer or June of 2014, when The Guardian had first published an article talking about trafficked slavery on Thai trawlers to catch food for prawns. And specifically what they had talked about were catching trash fish that was being used for fish meal that was turned into feed for then shrimp feed for shrimp farming. So recognizing that we have some of our products that are coming out of Thailand and that use this material, we of course started to take some action. And I owe a lot of credit to one individual within the company who, I didn't ask him if I could mention his name beforehand, so I'm just going to say Benjamin, for his leadership and guidance, because he was really the one who kind of kicked off the company into investigating and understanding this. But the first step in all this was to trace our supply chain. Right, we had an understanding of what our supply chain already existed, but we never traced it back to the degree that we did once we uncovered this. And we worked with a company to basically start tracing this back as far as possible as we could back to the individual ports. And then the next step in this was to find a credible third party that we could work with to help us understand and identify the human rights violations that were taking place within the supply chain. And through our network of other NGOs and partners that we work with, the name Verité had come up as a very credible partner who could work with us to help us do this investigation. And so we started working with Verite, and they helped to go through the supply chain that we had provided through our traceability work. And they did a multi-stage approach where they investigated it first by themselves and then brought us along and walked us through the entire supply chain. And then thirdly, we did it again, this time with our supply partners. In the middle of 2015, things really started to heat up. The story was getting louder and louder. And by now, we had already essentially finished our first report that was not public at the time, right? But that basically was an internal report highlighting all the issues that we were finding. And we were already starting to put into place actions with our individual suppliers on what we could do to help mitigate some of these risks, some of these challenges. And it wasn't until the New York Times and the Associated Press started publishing some articles where they specifically started mentioning Nestle by name and actually were showing product shots of some of our products to call us out and say, you know, here's who are some of the different companies that are sourcing from these supply chains. And I think this, for you, Ian, is the debate that we're getting to, right? And this is late 2015. And we're deciding whether or not at this point to go ahead and take all of the information that we've already gathered, including the development of our action plan, and make these public. And I remember having a long conversation with Lydia, who's going to speak next, around this, because as you can imagine, there are different groups within the organization that might find it, you know, like we're self-incriminating ourselves if we go ahead and open up about some of the things that we're finding. Others, on the other hand, were very proactive in saying, you know, these are things that we need to be talking about, need to be sharing, and share the activities that we're going to do as well. And so it made for a really, really great dialogue. And this conversation I was having with Lydia, and we talked more about the report, what we began to understand were that the issues that we were finding weren't just a Nestle supply chain issue. It was an endemic issue to the entire Thai industry. And in order for us to truly, you know, have any sort of impact on this, we would want to, of course, share the results of our findings in a way that talked about it in that way. And in the report, we ended up getting published on November 22nd in 2015. And in there, it talks about the recruitment practice and migrant labor conditions in our Thai seafood, our Thai shrimp supply chain. And specifically, it talks about the endemic nature of forced labor and human rights abuses that exist. At the same time, we also published our action plan. And I think what was good about that was that at that point now, you know, we're on the clock. We are now responsible for those things that we are putting out there publicly, of the actions that we're going to take, including keeping people up to date and showing progress on that. And so since that time, for the last couple of years, through 2016 and 2017, we have been making progress on our action plan. Some areas we've been able to go very, very quickly on. Some areas take a little bit more time. It requires a lot of collaboration. And we've been reporting on these things, certainly on an annual basis, sometimes more frequently as other news comes up. So that's how I'll go ahead and I'll start this off. Hopefully that gives you some good topics to discuss and some questions to ask, and I'll start there, and then I say let's move it on to Lydia.
No, thank you, Jack. Lydia, turning to you, perhaps you could give some background as to how Verite got involved with Nestle, what you were trying to do in your work with them, and the challenges you found in addressing the serious problems that were uncovered in this particular supply chain. Lydia.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you, Jack, for remembering that very long conversation we had. I remember it very well, as you know, also that the going out publicly with a report, and the Nestle gave us editorial judgment on exactly what we wanted to put in it. And it was a big step. It was a big step for any company. And I think that the V in the road at that point is, are we gonna, you know, go for the leadership position? And the leadership position really does embrace transparency. And as Jack said at the beginning of his remarks, and that's all in on learning from each other, which I think has been the direction of the main actors in Thailand since through their collaboration and the task force and others with where they're really putting sharing out front and trying to be strategic about the kinds of remedies that are going to get at the root causes of the problems that we've found. And that's the challenge of addressing these root causes are the challenge, are the big challenge of addressing what we found. And the supply chain mapping is a tricky kind of a thing. That's a very technical micro kind of an issue. The second also kind of micro is to get people thinking and talking not in terms of compliance and a response to newspaper articles or audit reports, and thinking more about change as something that's improvement in operational systems. That sounds a little bit wonky, but it really means as you build trust with stakeholders everywhere from, you know, a really large manufacturing organization to a small shrimp farmer to a vessel owner, as well as really government stakeholders as well, you have to build on what they already have. And that's a different kind of a conversation entirely. And that's a challenge. It's one that we have found that Nestle has supported us in working on. And this is where this is linked to, or it leads to, capacity building. There's so many, and going back to what's tough about all of this, there's so many factors at play. You have a government scrambling to try to have the yellow card, that's the threat of a boycott of its product, removed, kind of in a somewhat pell-mell way, although there have been changes coming out of what they've tried to do. You have the marketplace, you have boats pulled up because they're trying to address the issue with not enough fish to catch. You have poverty in neighboring countries that are driving people to come and work. So it's just not a very simple matter of zooming in on one kind of a factor when some of them are really even countervailing. And then I think the toughest thing, and I'm probably going to stop there and let you drill in a little bit with other questions, is the macro issue for companies like Nestle and others that are sourcing. And that is, what is the business case for the suppliers all the way through the supply chain? How do you cascade some form of business case down to make it worth taking on the costs? And let me just give you something to ponder when we talk about taking on the costs. When we're dealing with trafficking, and one of the biggest issues and the big risk indicator is whether workers are being charged and ending up in debt to get their job. And there's a widespread embrace of a no-fees policy, more explicit and more challenging is an employer pays policy, which means that if a worker's going to come work in your operation, you need to pay for all the costs of getting them there. Those aren't costs that most companies have been paying. Those are costs that the labor providers have not been paying. Those are costs that the workers have been paying. You're actually shifting cost up the supply chain, depending upon how to look at it. But the customer is actually being asked to absorb more of these costs. And where is that cost going to go? And it is probably not going to go to the consumer. So in the macro level, this is a massive challenge to solve this problem. But I'm going to stop there, and to make sure you direct us.
No, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I think we can come back to that issue. I think it's obviously a very important one. I want to just throw it back to Jack, and Lydia, do come in as well. Jack, how far was there a sense with you guys internally that when you were addressing this, you were giving yourselves work that you didn't have to do?
Say that one more time. A sense that we're doing work that we didn't have to do. What do you?
Well, that was it. I mean, how far was there a sense internally? And I imagine this will have changed over the course of your work. But was there a sense that, you know what, we don't actually have to do this? Do we really need to do it? And I wondered how did that change as you uncovered what was going on?
No, thank you. I think it's a great question. It was without a doubt that it was a sense that we have to do this. And I think we've taken that same approach with many other challenges that we have found in other areas of our supply chains. We recognize, right, that being a leader means that you're always going to be under the microscope. Someone's going to be, you know, you're going to be in the spotlight. Someone's going to be looking at you quite closely, criticizing your every move and things of that nature. So this was not a choice for us to not to address it, but rather for us to really, you know, take on this challenge head first and really dive into trying to understand exactly what the issues were. I would say that, you know, this is quite similar to other areas that we have experienced as well. And I guess what I would say is that it's one of those things that's very cultural and is part of who I think Nestle's purpose and brand is all about, our values. You know, these are things that we should not fear. These are things that we should, you know, step up to the challenge, right? We should be able to, you know, not fear having to walk the walk and to do the things that we feel that are necessary and important to not only, you know, help us ensure our business is there for the longevity, but to ensure that we're in some way returning value back to society.
Sure. And Lydia, a kind of similar question back to you. Obviously, you know, it's great to hear from Jack that, you know, Nestle really did want to take on this problem. But from your side of things, I'd imagine that's the answer that you'd expect and want to hear. But then that makes your job to make sure that they adhere to what they're saying. And how do you categorize or characterize the relationship you had with Nestle on that point?
Well, one of the pleasures of working with Nestle is that when they said, well, what's going to take to solve this problem? And we come back with something pretty elaborate and ultimately costly. They don't blink. And there's a number of companies who would ask for the same kind of a response. And then they say, can you do it for half? And can we skip this and can we skip that? And Nestle's interest in making sure that we really identify the objectives and then make sure that we're reaching them. At least that the approach, the thinking along those lines is not something that we have to be the ones niggling about that or actually deciding that we don't, you know, this is not a well considered approach. And I think that kind of defines walking the talk. Because it is, I think your question about did you really have to do it, and that most companies decide that, you know, what I'm really going to just do is move to another country. I'm gonna source someplace else, and that's often really what ends up happening.
Sure. Okay. Let's throw things forward a bit. Jack, can you talk to us a little bit about the two things, the supply chain monitoring program that Nestle has put in place with Thesara, and also the specific capacity building work that you're doing on the ground in Thailand?
Yeah, certainly. I'd be happy to talk to those things, because I think those are probably, you know, of all the different activities that we have going on right now, those are two that are very, very critical that are part of the work that we do. So, you know, we are partners with ISRA, the ISRA Institute, and I'll say this, right? I think that their inclusive labor monitoring program that they have has been phenomenal in helping us to identify where there are potential hotspots. They have worked, so how this works, if for those of on the phone or the webinar that maybe don't understand, right? We've worked with our suppliers to have them also partner with ISRA, and then have provided ISRA all of our supply chain information as far back as we possibly can, so that what ISRA can then do is start to work with each of those nodes within our supply chain to implement their labor monitoring program. Included in that is, signage and posters and leading people to not only a hotline number, but also leading them to an app that they have for their cell phones as well. And to have those individuals, those workers, be exposed to the opportunity to call in or to communicate online and share things that they may be seeing or hearing or feeling or experiencing in the workplace. With that, ISRA is allowed to code that and use that data to identify where there are particular challenges. They will notify us when they see something coming up, but then they'll also go out and they'll rectify it. They'll work with that supplier to say, hey, here's what we're finding, here's what we're learning, and here's what can be done. And then, report back to us as to what has been done. So the program itself, working with ISRA, has been fantastic, and we can't compliment them enough for the work that they've been doing. But then the other thing as well is then capacity building, right? And when we talk about some of the human right violations, those could extend to anything like some of the worst form of abuses that have been reported in the press, to things that are around safe and healthy working and living conditions. And in particular, for those individuals that are going out to sea, having access to sanitation, to clean water, to proper living conditions, proper working conditions were very important to us. And so one of the things that we did, working very closely with Thai Union, working closely with Verite, working very closely with CFDEC, as well as the Royal Thai Government, Department of Fisheries, we've developed a demonstration vessel, a demonstration in the sense of demoing how to, have a vessel that has safe working conditions, to have healthy living conditions, places for the workers to be able to store their belongings or to have a place where they can rest. And so through this project with the demonstration vessel, we just launched it. It's taken us quite some time to locate a vessel, get the partners together, make changes to the vessel that meets some standards for the ILO, and then to go out there and do a couple of trainings to start to build that program up, recognizing there's learnings that you're going to have along the way. And so going into this next year, we're hoping to be able to conduct more of those sort of trainings using this demonstration vessel. So those are two key critical areas that were part of our action plan. And here we are a couple years later, now having delivered on those things through supply chain monitoring, as well as capacity building, all the way down to the individual workers, that is.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. Lydia, if I may, I'll come back to you for some thoughts on capacity building in a sec, but I'd like to bring in Michael now. Michael, perhaps you can reflect on what you've heard so far and what would have been Nestle's options at the time from a legal perspective. And also, I think more interestingly, perhaps, what would be different from a legal perspective for a company in a similar position right now? Michael.
Thanks, Ian. Well, first of all, just like to say it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks very much for the Innovation Forum for inviting me to join. I think it's very interesting listening to Jack's story about how Nestle discovered the issue and what it did back in 2015, because from a legal perspective, one of the things that's most striking about this area of law is how quickly it's developing. And actually, in the extent to which the legal landscape is actually quite different now in 2018 to even what it was like in 2015 when the issues that Jack and Lydia have been talking about first came to light. So, there are a couple of developments that I can point to which will be familiar, I'm sure, to most of the people in the webinar, such as the coming into force of the Modern Slavery Act in the United Kingdom, and also legislation such as the French duty of vigilance law in France. And they're very important because what Jack was talking about is the kinds of thoughts that were going through Nestlé's minds and the decision as to whether they should report on these issues that they were thinking about in 2015. Well, I mean, what this legislation actually means is that companies have less wiggle room about whether they can or can't report on these things. They actually have to report on their modern slavery compliance, and that obligation is in some places, such as in the UK in particular, at the moment, a fairly sort of broad obligation just to say what a company is doing to address modern slavery in its supply chain. But as similar legislation comes into force in places around the world, and most notably recently in France, companies are actually being required to do more and say more about what they're doing. So the decision for a company about whether to report at all is actually rather a different one to what it was even 3 years ago. So, and I think now something like a modern slavery issue in a company supply chain is an issue that a company would address in a not dissimilar way to if it found, for example, bribery in its somewhere in its operation, or even a competition law issue. And in certain circumstances, I think discovering this kind of issue would provoke a sort of crisis response from a company, and which would be quite different to maybe how a company would have responded to that certainly 10 years ago and possibly more recently than that. So Jack talks a little bit about the sort of dialogue that was going on within the company, and he talks about people who wanted to sort of put the report out there and get it out there, and the importance of disclosure. And he also talked a little bit about voices within the company that were in opposition to that. And I think that kind of dialogue is now very important within a company, and it's very important that companies actually report on this stuff as they are now legally obliged to do, but in the right way. So one thing we're seeing alongside all the introduction of this legislation that requires companies to say more is the growth in an actual other kinds of legal risks. So particularly litigation risks, which are arising out of what companies are saying in their modern slavery statements, in their California transparency and supply chain statements, in their CSR and human rights reporting more generally. We're seeing cases being brought in the UK where companies who haven't lived up to the action plans they put in place, or haven't lived up to what they said in their human rights policies, are being targeted by claimant side law firms and sued in the courts on the basis that they haven't actually done what they said they were going to do. So when Jack talks about the Nestlé action plan and all of the detailed provisions that they put in there about what they were going to do, it's very important that for the company that they have actually gone on to deliver on those promises. And what that means is that when companies are reporting on this, which they absolutely should do, and Jack has, and Lydia have very eloquently described the importance of being transparent in this kind of area, it means that what they're putting out there has to be very rigorous. It has to be the kind that companies can no longer make bold or very broad statements that they can't actually live up to. They need to, if they're going to talk the talk, they also do need to walk the walk, and that's become a very important legal risk issue.
What do you think, Michael, is the appetite then for litigation? I mean, Jack mentioned in his remarks, you know, the dangers of self-incrimination. Is this something then that companies, and it almost feels like a step backwards, doesn't it? I mean, if companies in fact now are transparent about what's going on, is there a real risk of them then, you know, NGOs or activists sticking out litigation against them?
It's a question which has been posed quite a lot, and increasingly there are voices making that exact almost criticism of this. But I don't think that it should be seen necessarily as having a chilling effect on what companies are saying in this space, and certainly not on what they're doing. What it means is that companies need to do what they say they're going to do. They need to put out statements, they need to put out policies which they can stand behind. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't make them in the first place, and it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be making these promises and coming up with innovative solutions to what is a very, very difficult situation and a very difficult issue to address, particularly in very long and complex supply chains. But what it does mean is that when they actually say these things, it's very important that they are put together with the degree of commercial and legal rigor that a company would apply to any of its public statements, any of its disclosures. So yes, there may be people lining up to try and seek ways to make companies' lives more difficult in this respect, but that is fundamentally equates to holding companies to what they have said in their statements. And that's true now, increasingly true in this area, and it has been true in corporate disclosures for many years. So it shouldn't be something which comes as a great surprise or comes as a great sea change in what a company is saying.
Okay, no, thank you, Michael. Jack, can I put that point back to you? I mean, obviously, in your conversations internally in 2014 and 2015, I would imagine the sorts of risks that Michael has been elaborating, discussing, will have been front of mind with you. How internally did you get around them, and how did you sort of face up, if you like, to the potential legal risks that you may be exposing yourself to by being transparent?
No, absolutely. And so having conversations like this, right, these aren't easy decisions by any means. And these are things that are going to require the viewpoint of a lot of different subject matter experts within the company. So you're going to have individuals who, you know, they understand the media, you know, public affairs. You're going to have, you know, your legal counsel there, maybe even external legal counsel coming, helping to provide advice. At the same time, right, you're going to have others within the organization that are going to be saying, you know, here's what we believe we can do from a supply chain perspective, from a procurement perspective. You know, how can we make changes, you know, within the way in which we're sourcing and so forth, bring that commercial aspect to it at the same time. And you have to weigh all those different perspectives together to say, you know, we are going to share any information that we have, we're going to be transparent, but to Michael's point, right, we're going to be making, you know, this action plan up with these 10 different actions. What are the ones that we feel, you know, we could truly not only have a positive impact on the situation, but that we believe that we can deliver on, right? We do not ever want to overstate what it is that we're trying to achieve for, you know, some sort of, you know, building of our brand or something of that nature, right? We're wanting to put something out there that is very much actionable and that we recognize might be a stretch goal, but that we're, you know, is going to challenge us to help us, you know, solve the situation. So those conversations early on, Ian, I don't think there was ever going to be truly a debate that we weren't going to be transparent about this. It was, you know, more about, you know, how are we going to operationalize this and so forth. And I think something else that's worth mentioning that when we talked about, you know, sharing this information, we weren't actually the ones sharing it. We were commissioning Verité to share this, right? And we gave them, as Lydia mentioned, a lot of liberty in what they were sharing. So we wrote the action plan, right? Nestle developed the action plan, but we wanted Verité to very independently in some way share what they were finding out there in the supply chains. In other words, Ian, you know, we weren't wanting to in any way not be transparent in the issues that we were finding, but, you know, and therefore having Verité do it was much, much more along those lines. But certainly having the broader conversation within the company as to how we're going to make promises and deliver against those promises through our action plan, that was definitely something that there was a lot of discussion around.
Sure. Okay, thanks very much. And thank you to the audience. There's a lot of you out there today, and we've had a lot of questions, so thank you very much indeed. Do keep sending them in. I want to turn to a question that someone brought up, in fact, which reflects something that a point that Lydia made earlier on. And it's really the kind of the question of who pays for the work required to deal with these problems, and particularly how you split this across the value chain. I mean, typically food prices are driven down by retailers, and, you know, are they reflecting the true cost? So, Lydia, let's put your question back to you. You know, how do you think companies have to go about working with the value chain here to make sure that the value goes all the way down so that everyone benefits from doing the right thing?
Well, that's thank you to the questioner for putting it in those terms. And it really is the hidden cost of sustainability, or maybe not sustainability, because sustainability describes the ideal, which is that you're paying for for all of those costs. Let's just call it the cost of compliance or the cost of human rights. We don't have the answer for that. That's something that we are in constant conversation with the companies about, is because they move that around. And one of the things that we do bring back to some of the companies we work with, and in fact, some of them are open to it, and that is, as you, as the, you know, the top of the food chain in terms of the product, are you, you know, how are you contributing to ultimately the conditions, the bad conditions at the far end of the supply chain? Is it potentially the way you forecast or don't favor, you know, I mean, are you, is your so-called balanced scorecard, in which you're supposed to be rewarding your suppliers, not just based on price, delivery, and quality, but are they actually getting rewarded by being potentially a preferred supplier and having longer and more more predictable business with you for being a good actor and for having demonstrating that the, you know, that the workforce itself is being, you know, treated fairly and under legal conditions. That's something that some companies actually are really interested in. They're inviting us to do training of procurement teams and buyer teams so that they can spot issues and hopefully take that back and internalize some of the decisions around rewarding good behavior. But it's really better a question for Jack, and I'm really excited to hear his answer.
Indeed. Well, I did want to give Jack a little bit of a rest, as he'd been quite a long answer before that. But Jack, yes, please, can we put the question to you? How do you, you know, from Nestle's perspective, how do you split the question of who pays for these things across the value chain? And what are the challenges for doing so when you've got retailers who are, you know, in many respects, driving down costs rather than, you know, thinking about in terms of greater value in the value chain?
Yeah, that's a very challenging question to answer, because I don't feel like you can swing it one way or the other, right? I don't think you're looking at extremes here, and until you start to, you know, map out everything that is taking place and truly understand the cost. And I'm guessing here, right, when we say pay the cost, you're talking about, you know, what? So let me ask, maybe before I jump into this, Ian, when you're talking about the costs, right, what are the, are you talking about the financial cost of actually taking action against these things?
I guess more the question of making sure that everybody, obviously that there is going to be cost to the remediation, there's going to be a cost, yeah, to work required to make the change necessary. But it, I think the questioner's point was, in a context of retailers really fighting to get costs down, get prices down for consumers, how do you then ensure that there's enough value going all the way through the value chain to ensure that, in fact, the problems are solved? I think that's what we're trying, what we're aiming at.
Yeah, this is one that, you know, within Nestle, if in this particular case in Thailand, the financial investments that we're making in order to have improvements in the supply chain from which we source to ensure that we do not have human rights abuses or human rights violations, you know, we actually bear a lot of those costs. Now, working closely with the suppliers also incur some of those costs, and it trickles, you know, little by little down the line. I think we have, you know, some benefit to this in that, you know, the way in which it's being spread about and who we're working with, there's been a lot of others who have been very much willing to take on those costs and to absorb them. And it's very much more operational in nature. But, you know, we're not the only ones that are part of this supply chain. We're not the only ones that are in this industry. And so for a lot of those individual retailers, which the vast majority of them are sourcing from these same supply chains, they too have an obligation to invest in, you know, improving the situation over there as well. And these costs do roll up across everyone. But if everyone is in there and contributing to it, you know, it should not, you know, cause too great of an increase in the overall price. It's when you have only a few players that are making larger investments that it starts to negatively impact them. And so what it really requires is broader industry action and broader, you know, investment from everyone who is part of the supply chain. Unfortunately, when these articles come out in the press, they seem to target only a handful of customers, right? And it's often because they know that if they target very specific names, they're going to be able to get higher readership levels, more eyeballs onto the article. And so you tend to hear about the same organizations over and over again. But, you know, I just want to remind you that there's a lot of others that have that same sort of obligation.
Sure. And I guess to really deal with these issues, collaboration is the only way forward. Everybody involved has to be working and moving it in the same direction. But, you know, thank you very much, Jack, for that candid answer. Michael, I got a question for you. Specifically, our questioner wants to know what the legal implications are of reporting no progress in modern slavery. What are the risks for a company if that's the case? And who should they be thinking in terms of as potential litigants against them?
Thanks, Ian. It's a very good question. I think the short answer is, I mean, the question is asked about progress. So I think we can assume here that we're talking about a company that has either put out a statement or its human rights policy is very basic and doesn't really say very much, and it is showing no signs of increasing its compliance. I think the answer to that depends a little bit on the countries in which they're operating and the kinds of disclosure obligations that apply to them. So, I mean, in places like the UK, you can legally comply with the Modern Slavery Act by putting out a statement which says that the company doesn't take very much action to deal with modern slavery. And there would be no specific regulatory or litigation risk arising out of such a statement. But what's more interesting in the way that this legal world is developing is that in countries like France, there is actually now an obligation to take specific action to deal with particular issues. So in those kinds of countries, not actually doing anything might increasingly become the kind of action that is liable for example, civil penalties, or for it could potentially ground litigation. I think we are a way away at the moment from a regime anywhere in the world which says if you're doing nothing, you are liable for a particular penalty. The risks that exist at the moment are really focused on not delivering on what you're saying. But there are various legislative measures that have been proposed in various jurisdictions, including in the UK, that may actually create a bit more positive force behind the idea that companies can be held to account where they don't put sufficient structures in place to prevent these things. So the bribery example is a good read across here. So the UK Bribery Act, if a company discovers that they are somehow linked to bribery, there is a defense to the criminal and civil penalties that can apply in that circumstance. If the company has in place sufficient procedures and policies to combat that issue. Now, the Modern Slavery Act and the other bits of modern slavery legislation that are enforced in various places around the world don't currently include that those kinds of penalties or that kind of structure, but that is something that has been proposed, most notably last spring, the All Party Parliamentary Group on Human Rights in the UK proposed amending the Modern Slavery Act to introduce that very kind of system which then would put in place essentially a legal a sanction if a company failed to address and put in place sufficient policies to deal with modern slavery risks in its business and its supply chains. So it's a case of it's something which might happen in the future, but at the moment, just doing nothing or not making enough progress is not in and of itself enough to found legal liability.
Okay, no, thank you very much, Michael, for that very comprehensive answer. I want to turn back to Jack and Lydia. I've got a question around some of the specifics of dealing with issues in supply chains, and it's around the challenges of verification. What are the principal challenges that you found verifying that the activities you're hoping are improving in the supply chain? How do you go about verifying them? What are the challenges around verification? Jack, perhaps I can come to you first. I think we may have lost Jack. Lydia, perhaps I can turn to you then. From your perspective, Lydia, what are the main challenges of getting the verification right when you're looking at supply chain remediation?
Thank you, Ian. The most important information to our mind, or between 30 and 40% of information that needs to be verified, can only come from workers. And there is a lot of pressure to reduce the cost of auditing and reduce the number of audits. There's a lot of audit fatigue. And one of the ways in which this can happen is really shorting the audit process. And so we find that the kinds of critical information needed isn't often captured. And that's just, again, that's kind of a price point issue. And companies, the larger the companies, the retailers especially, that have tens of thousands of sites that they're accountable for, it's easy to understand why they can't, they need the kind of model that they can actually spread out across their entire supply chain. So tapping workers is critical. Hearing from the experts on the ground, who are the NGOs, this is something that actually is happening more in Thailand. It's one of the good news stories coming out, and that is the expanded relationships with the local NGOs. And this was not a country that had embraced NGOs as a key stakeholder. Jack mentioned ISRA is one hotline that there's others. LPN is another that has hotlines. And so it's really not trying to get all of the information from one source, but to triangulate that information across multiple sources. But it is a slog. It's different in when it is environmental issues. They're observable. You literally can send one person for a site in Thailand. There may be Cambodian, Laotian, Vietnamese, and Burmese workers, as well as Thai workers. And you really need to speak to them in their native language because of the issue of trust and the kinds of really tricky questions that need to be asked. So it's the level of effort required, I think,
Thanks, Lydia. Now, Jack, I know you're having some audio problems. Are you on the line there, Jack? Are you able to hear us?
I am back on the line, but I'm so disappointed because you asked a great question of Michael that would have been some great free legal advice, and I missed it. So I'll have to ask him again some other time.
Well, let me put the question I just put to Lydia to you then. It's just really around the challenges of verification. Clearly, complex supply chains, making sure that you can be certain that what you want to be happening is happening is a real challenge. What are the specific challenges you found when you've been introducing your action plan?
Let me share. So there are certainly some challenges, and you know, Ian, I tend to be very transparent, very open book, and I can't wait to the meeting June 12th and 13th in New York City, because I'm looking forward to speaking even more freely at that conference and sharing even more. Let me share some of the positive things, right? Because I feel like that is where we need to begin focusing. And that's just my two cents on this, right? But, you know, some of the things that have been really working extremely well as we dive into our action plan is finding the collaboration with the supply chain partners. And when you deal with a challenge such as this and you start to approach your supply chain partners, what you find out, first of all, is that they have, as Justin, having concern for the workers, for their safety, for their care, and wanting to make sure that there's an improvement and that there's, you know, changes that could be made. And so the collaboration has been a very, very warm, welcoming surprise. And I really give a lot of credit to our supply chain partners for making that happen. The other thing is then being able to dive deep and understand exactly what's happening on the ground. You know, all of these issues, they begin with the workers themselves. And so, you know, through the work that we've had with ISRA and being able to go and visit and have this deep understanding of some of the challenges, you begin to learn, right, that what you're dealing with here is a challenge. It's not necessarily insurmountable. There are bad actors, and unfortunately, you know, driving them out of the system requires greater work through either government regulations or through cooperation with the police force or things of that nature. But you definitely need to, you know, have that deep understanding in order to be able to identify the things that you can move and the things that you can make you know, work. And I think that having that deep understanding with a partner like, with Verite has been fantastic. And so those are just some of the great things that that we have discovered, certainly as we've gone through on this journey.
And a question to come in that's just right relevant for what we were just talking about. And it specifically asks, how are you, Jack, and you, Lydia, leveraging your work in the on the Seafood Task Force to make sure that companies that, you know, that everyone is contributing together, and so that there is not that outsized impact on the handful of companies, the high profile companies you mentioned, Jack. So how are you working? How does the Seafood Task Force work to make sure that everybody involved in the sector is having to engage and deal with these matters? Jack.
Okay, I'll go first. So yes, we are members of the Seafood Task Force, right? And they have, first of all, which is just a fabulous contingent that is across the entire supply chain, right? So you have retailers from Europe and the US all the way down to the individual owners of the vessels that are participating, right? And everyone in between. And so through this, the Seafood Task Force, they have several different subgroups. I think there's 8 subgroups at the moment, and each of them working together cross-functionally through the supply chain, addressing very specific challenges. And we certainly rely heavily on the work of that Seafood Task Force and some of those subgroups in order to help us move with the industry as change is being made. At the same time, because of the way in which I think that us as a large company that's constantly under the spotlight, and because we had gone out there publicly early on with our action plan addressing the challenges that we found through our own investigation, we have our own work at the same time. Now, I don't see them as conflicting. I see them as complementing each other. And there's things that we're certainly learning through the work that we're doing, that is through either remediation or through capacity building or through supply chain monitoring, that is at the same time complementing the work that is being done with traceability, with understanding the shrimp feed supply chain process, with validation and auditing and so forth. And so to me, those two things have been working very much hand in hand together as we've progressed on this journey for Nestlé.
Thank you. Lydia, could you answer the same point? What are you seeing the benefits of multi-stakeholder groups like the Seafood Task Force? Is that the way really to ensure that everybody has to move forward and not just the big companies that get called out?
Well, that's a kind of a tricky question. And I think Jack pointed out one thing, that it goes back to what one of the things that he very first said, and I called that out again, and that is the sharing, the sharing of information, that the work that Nestle's doing will actually ultimately come back to the task force as a case study that I think that the culture of the task force currently is to share lessons, both good and bad, and that sort of reach that point, having a lot of stability in the membership. The trick is that the bigger companies have just more financial muscle to do innovation, to absorb some of the cost of the change. But ultimately, it is getting pushed down to the smaller operators. And when it's a very long supply chain, and we have really small operators at the far end who the idea of being able to refit a boat so that there's more room for crew members to sleep is a make or break choice for them. And same thing at the other end, the shrimp farms. These are almost small older shrimp farms, and they've barely heard of the task force code of conduct, and they're really operating in a very much of a transactional day-to-day basis. So that's I think that's a challenge when we look at it, like making sure everybody's doing it. And maybe what the question infers is that all of the high profile big muscle companies are all equally sharing in the cost for them to take leadership roles. And if that's the question, then I think that the answer is that there's a fair amount of accountability when everybody's in the room together. And a Walmart or a Costco, it's they're kind of looking at each other in the eye about, you know, who is stepping up and who isn't. So that part of the culture of the task force, I think, has been very positive.
Thank you very much indeed. We're coming towards the end of our time. I've got one more question from Michael, but I'd like to put a final question to Jack and Lydia, just very briefly. And really, the question is very simply, what's coming up next? How's the action plan for Nestle going to develop? And what do you see as the challenges in sorting out supply chains in Thailand specifically, perhaps more generally as well? Jack, coming back to you.
So I'm gonna make it very brief because I do see the clock and that we're running out of time. But you know, we've made a lot of progress on our action plan. We did have a public announcement on the progress that was out earlier this year. We're going to revisit that action plan now over the course of this year. And as you go through these processes, you learn new things, and so we're wanting to go ahead and update it and start to make sure that we're continuing to, you know, advance as the overall industry begins to advance and progress is being made.
Okay, thanks very much. Lydia, for you, what are you seeing?
I'll keep it
more broadly.
Yeah, you
keep it nice.
Sorry, Ian, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just maybe trying to broaden it slightly into other, you know, into broader commodity supply chains. What do you think we're going to see next in terms of the modern slavery challenges and dealing with them?
The coming on of broker certification schemes, which also brings with it a big question, who's going to pay for that? But that's going to be at least create a marketplace for good actors, because right now, if you say the broker that you're using is enslaving people, well, where else are you going to go? Sometimes there is no other choice. The other one quickly will be getting our arms around impact. There's a lot of activity. How much of it has actually had impact? So that's I think going to be something that everybody's going to have to put their shoulders to the coming year or two.
And Michael, turning to you, we've got a specific question that I wonder if you could use it to throw things forward slightly. How do you think that national governments are going to be held accountable for tackling problems of labour and human rights abuses? We talked about companies, but how are governments going to be held accountable if nothing's been done in their own area of jurisdiction?
It's a very good question. Partly the reason we have things like the Modern Slavery Act and partly we have things like the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights is because, and on in a pure real politic way, the certain of the responsibility for dealing with these issues has had to be passed to companies because in many jurisdictions, the local law, the local regulation is not up to scratch. But at the same time, that's the modern slavery as an issue exists not only in sort of the traditional hotspot areas like Southeast Asia, but it does exist in the UK, in the US, and in very much in the Western world too. So what could be done to hold governments to account? Well, that's really up to civil society, and that's really up to the people to get in touch with their lawmakers and to put pressure on the right organizations to keep the legislative wave and that has been building over the last couple of years to keep that going.
Sure. Well, perhaps a bit of an open question to finish with, but thank you very much indeed, Michael. I'm going to have to stop this discussion as we are running out of time. I would like to thank our panel, Michael, Lydia and Jack, very much indeed for their time, their insight and their candor today. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on business and the imperatives to tackle modern slavery, then please do join us in New York in June. We will send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen to it again at your leisure or share with your colleagues. Now, we always welcome feedback at Innovation Forum, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us with follow-up questions or comments. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much for listening.